This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive. Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. It's a pleasure to be with you this December 6th, beautiful morning, coming to you from the studios at 90.1 KPFT here in Houston, Texas, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. And you can find us as well at www.newcapitalshow.com. Coming up later in the show, Laverne Williams, one of the great green architects here in Texas, and we're going to be talking about the state of architecture in general, and of course the state of green architecture. An awful lot going on there, and Laverne will be on hand to help us understand some of the changes. First, I'd like to get to a few news items and a few other things. It was a, you know, it was a baby morning for me. Every morning is baby morning. I have a 9-month-old, and I don't know what it is. Maybe somebody can send me an email or something. Tell me why babies are so happy when they wake up, you know, in the morning. It's the most extraordinary. They're babbling. Laura, do you know? They're rested. What is the story?
I think they had a good dream.
They had a good dream?
Mm-hmm.
They're the happiest little creatures. And I have a 9-month-old son. And if you wanted to have a peaceful world, what you would do is make it possible for all daddies to have, you know, 30 minutes in bed every morning. The baby comes and jumps on you, jumps on your head, and crawls all over and is laughing. And the first year of the baby's life, that's what the baby does every morning. And it's a thrilling thing. And I think that there should be an international law that all daddies, the first year, have got to spend 30 minutes of baby morning. Every morning, you would see a total transformation of the planet. That more than anything. You know, you're exempted if you've got an early job that requires that you come in at 6 a.m. You've got a baby first year, you're off until, you know, you don't have to come in until 7:30, 8 o'clock, whatever the case is. That would be the best thing that we could do. I just can't tell you what a delight it is to be able to spend time with your baby first year of their life. So there's my advocacy for baby mornings for daddies. I promise you, it would solve a lot of problems. Overcomes a lot. Let's get to a few environmental items. Somebody called in a few weeks, maybe it was a week ago, asking about contrails. You know, those wispy exhaust plumes that are put out in the sky in the back of airplanes. I don't know, maybe a lot of people said, what is this call? Well, I mean, it's a big deal. EPA is prodded to require cuts in airliner emissions. 5 states, New York City, of course, and several environmental groups filed petitions with the EPA on Wednesday in an effort to force cuts in emissions of heat-trapping gases from airliners, a rapidly growing source of emissions. The petitions are part of an international drive led by Europe to curb the aircraft emissions, which are growing along with the growth in air travel. Supreme Court told the EPA in April that the agency had the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from automobiles, a step the agency had resisted. Of course, the EPA is run by the Bush administration. This is an executive branch department and is basically under the control of the president. And so up until April, when the Supreme Court said that, in fact, the EPA does have the right and the authority to regulate carbon dioxide, EPA said it didn't. Anyway, so focus now as well on airliners. Last week I presented to you the news that there is now focus on ships which burn, what was it called? What was that stuff called? I can't remember what that stuff was called. Some kind of fuel. It's basically asphalt. 90% of the world's goods are sent back and forth across the oceans, and they burn asphalt. Somebody said, you can walk on this stuff. So, great things going on, great focus going on in different areas, all different areas of transportation, not just cars, looking at airplanes, looking at ships as well. December 6th, John Broder in the New York Times, Senate panel passes bill to limit greenhouse gases. A Senate committee approved a broad bill. This is a committee. Approved a broad bill on Wednesday night. Last night. This is hot off the press. To address climate change. A major step toward passage of a measure that would for the first time slow and then reverse emissions of the gases that scientists blame for the warming of the planet. The Environment and Public Works Committee split largely along party lines on the bill, which calls for a roughly 70% cut from 2005 levels by the year 2050 in the production of carbon dioxide and other climate-altering pollutants. The legislation would limit emissions for virtually all sectors of the economy, but would allow swapping of pollution permits among carbon emitters. The legislation, which is opposed by a powerful array of forces, including utilities, oil companies, and manufacturers, faces an arduous path through the full Senate. Remember, this is just passed in the committee. This is the Environment and Public Works Committee, which up until the election last year was controlled by Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, who, wow. I mean, this guy, I get the emails from his guys still. It used to be that if you thought global warming was occurring, you were out there. Inhofe is now the guy who's out there, and the committee is now who controls. Let's see who is now the head of the committee. Maybe Barbara Boxer. Yeah, she's the chairwoman. Senator Barbara Boxer, the California Democrat, who is chairwoman of the Environment Committee, called the vote the greatest accomplishment of her 30-year political career. She said, "This vote is a historic moment for my country. It is a signal that America is finally taking bold steps to avert a catastrophe for our children and grandchildren." You think it doesn't matter who controls the Congress? I beg to differ. I think you're not correct. Senators Joseph Lieberman, independent of Connecticut, and John Warner, Republican of Virginia, also sponsored the measure. They said it was a historic first step. So you are getting some conservatives crossing party lines, and that's good. We need conservatives. We need conservatives who want to conserve, who want to conserve the atmosphere. I say this every time I come on the radio. You conservatives are part of the solution. Don't know that the Republican Party will be part of the solution. I hope it will. John Warner is a Republican, sponsored this measure. So this is good news. This is just out last night. Let's see, what else in the news? From across the ocean, bad news from Sumatra in Indonesia. Forest loss in Sumatra is becoming a global issue. Here on the island of Sumatra, about 1,200 miles from the global climate talks that are underway on Bali, are located some of the world's fastest disappearing forests. A look at the vast wasteland of charred stumps and dried out peat makes the fight to save Indonesia's forests seem nearly impossible, said Pak Helman, 28, a villager here in the Riau province, surveying the scene from his leaking wooden longboat. He says, "What can we possibly do to stop this? I feel lost. I feel abandoned." In recent years, dozens of pulp and paper companies have descended on Riau, which is roughly the size of Switzerland. snatching up generous government concessions to log and establish palm oil plantations. The results have caused villagers to feel panic. And this article goes on to talk about the fact that palm oil is now being looked at as a biodiesel fuel. We have to be careful when we advocate for certain forms of alternative energy. There can be unintended consequences, and this is what's going on in Sumatra, in Indonesia. Palm oil is now the object of human affection, not just for cooking of products, but also for burning as biodiesel. This is why it's so vital that we have United States leadership. This is vital that we have planning taking place in concert by all the nations of the world, so everyone can sit down and discuss and think through very carefully what should the energy profile of our planet be. We live in an interconnected world. We're not doing well if we're in the United States burning energy while poor people in Indonesia are watching their land being decimated at the hands of those who've taken control of it. It's not right. It's not fair. We need to do something about it. Here's an article just off the press, 70 killed in a China mine explosion. You may or may not know, 4,000 people are killed every year in China. China gets 75% of its energy from the burning of coal, and they are expanding that and growing the amount of coal that they pulverize and incinerate every single year. Coal production was 2.2 billion tons in 2005. By 2010, it's going to be 2.5 billion tons. This morning, we learned that a gas explosion at a coal mine in northern China has killed at least 70 people and left at least 26 others trapped in one of the country's worst mining accidents this year. The Chinese government has decided that this is a price that they're willing to pay to industrialize, and yet we're reminded every single day of the enormous toll that coal takes on the world. It has an enormous effect on the environment, from the mining of coal, the destruction of mountains and rivers and streams, from tailings and waste that comes from coal, as we now know, from the pollution that comes from carbon dioxide, and for those plants that don't have scrubbers on them, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, other pollutants get into the air and that cause acid rain and the release of mercury into the oceans, the lakes, the streams, and as we learn today from this news bit, enormous human costs from the mining of coal. Planet faces very serious issues if we are not able to get hold of our coal consumption and, frankly, to stop it and to go to better ways to produce energy. Let's see. I think a bit of good news. You probably know about the fuel economy law that was passed Congress late Friday, last Friday. I haven't been on since then, so I just want to point out from Washington on November 30th, congressional negotiators reached a deal late Friday on energy legislation that would force American automakers to improve the fuel efficiency of their cars and light trucks by 40% by the year 2020. The proposal, which would require automakers to achieve 30 miles per gallon on average, is similar to a measure that was passed in the summer by the Senate, but was bitterly opposed by the auto companies, who argued that they did not have the technology or the financial resources to reach that goal. Right, we've heard this before, right? Auto companies don't have the financial resources or the technology to put seat belts in, or to put airbags in, or to put other safety. We've heard this over and over and over and over again. And the truth is that the technology is there. We are able to do these things. We are able to improve the efficiency of our transportation fleet, and we should be doing that. The final deal was hammered out by the two main antagonists, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. I still remember last November hosting election night here at KPFT when it was announced that Nancy Pelosi had become the first Speaker of the House, first female Speaker of the House in United States history. And here we have, 1 year later, Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat of California, facing down another Democrat, Michigan Democrat John Dingell, 82 years old, who has been in Congress for 3 or 4 decades now, and who is the auto industry's most effective advocate. As we see, Just because a Democrat doesn't mean that he's going to buck the trend. He is bought and paid for. John Dingell is by the auto industry, and he represents his constituents in Detroit to the last gasp. And in this case, we have seen Nancy Pelosi has faced down John Dingell and has passed this law. John Dingell has made several comments that he simply didn't have the power to overcome Nancy Pelosi. Don't think that your vote doesn't count. Your vote counts. There's going to be an election next year. Please, please understand that your vote counts. I want to get to one more thing. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll have Laverne Williams, green architect based here in Texas. But first, I want to talk about the news of the nuclear, national intelligence estimate, the United States national intelligence estimate, that has come out declaring that and deciding and concluding that the country of Iran, against which our president and his administration has been engaged in a war of words for quite a while now, our national intelligence estimate, of course, we don't know whether to trust those things, right? Because we went to war in Iraq, one of the reasons, at least, or one of the rationalizations and legitimizations of that war was a national intelligence estimate, which concluded that Iraq was producing weapons of mass destruction. We now have a national intelligence estimate that's been issued and released, which says that Iran stopped efforts to develop an atomic bomb in 2003. This, of course, is, I don't know, this is the big news this week, Laura, I think. Yeah. I think it's the big news. So we've had George W. Bush, who, folks, cannot pronounce the word nuclear. He cannot pronounce it, or will not pronounce it. I don't know which. He cannot pronounce it, or he will not pronounce it. I mean, do you know how hard it is to give someone credibility on this colossal, critical issue? The control and the future of nuclear weapons. And I've been talking about nuclear weapons over the past few weeks. Some of you sent me emails. Why are you still talking about Hiroshima? Why am I still talking about Hiroshima? Look at the news this week. What is the news? The news is about the United States war of words over whether Iran has an atomic weapon. This is decades after Hiroshima. This is why I'm talking about Hiroshima. Because if we don't understand our own nuclear history, how can we be making educated pronouncements? How can we be carrying cogent arguments about another country's efforts in this area? And as we know, the president cannot pronounce or will refuses to pronounce. I've seen some theories that pronouncing the word nuclear as nuclear, that there are politicians who knowingly do this because the mispronunciation and apparently the phonetics of nuclear are easier than the phonetics of nuclear. I haven't found that to be the case. I can say both words okay, but you know, I'm a radio show host, so I'm supposed to be able to do those things. But I can see how if you have some form of audio dyslexia or whatnot, the word nuclear could prove difficult. And furthermore, I could see how if you hear nuclear all the time, how that could embed itself in your pronunciation. I understand that. I got it. And I understand that for whatever reason in our language, nuclear may be easier to say, like ocular or some other word like that. But you would think that if you are going to be the president of the United States, and you're going to spend all the time on the things that you spend time on, your aides would at least come to you and say, Mr. President, we got to spend today. We're going to spend Thursday, December 6th, all day. We're going to spend it on getting the word pronounced right. Because you must have credibility if you're going to discuss this issue. So it's nuclear. Here we go. Ready? Nuclear. Nuclear. Try it again. Nuclear. Let's break it down. Nuclear. No, nothing like that happens. The president resists and continues to pronounce it nuclear. And as I said, there's some indications, or I've read some studies somewhere, or some opinions really, not studies, that pronouncing it nuclear in that sort of lazy drawl is meant to appeal, you know, to rank-and-file voters. I think it's intellectual laziness, which we've seen an awful lot of from this president. And I've been most fascinated, not most fascinated, but I was very fascinated to read something from Thomas Friedman, who I think is really, I think he's a great columnist. As I've said, I think he's been wrong, or was wrong, in the days right after 9/11. Not on all things, but on a lot of things. But he's really gotten it right now. And he has a very interesting column I'd like to present to you a few minutes before we get to Laverne Williams. He says, he titles his art, his op-ed, "Intercepting Iran's Take on America." Top of the article, he says, "There are two intelligence analyses that are relevant to the balance of power between the U.S. and Iran. One is the latest U.S. assessment of Iran, which certainly, and this is what I was just discussing, this latest U.S. assessment, which said that it appears that Iran stopped efforts to develop an atomic bomb in 2003. So the two documents, the two analyses that are relevant to the balance of power between U.S. and Iran, says Tom Friedman, one is the latest U.S. assessment of Iran, which certainly gave a much more complex view of what is happening there. And the other is the Iranian National Intelligence Estimate of America." Right? I mean, we never think about that. This is what's so brilliant about Friedman's article. We only think about the U.S. National Intelligence Estimate of Iran. Well, folks, there's somewhere there's, in the vaults there, in Iran, there is an Iranian National Intelligence Estimate of America, Friedman says, which my guess would read something like this. And Friedman goes on to speculate what that Iranian intelligence estimate of our country would look like. And here's the memo to President Ahmadinejad from the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence. Subject: America. And this is what the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence has to say in Tom Friedman's fantasy, in his imagination. He says, or they say, addressing President Ahmadinejad, "As you'll recall, in the wake of 9/11, we were extremely concerned that the U.S. would develop a covert program to end its addiction to oil, which would be the greatest threat to Iranian national security. In fact, after Bush's 2006 State of the Union, in which he decried America's oil addiction, we had high confidence that a comprehensive U.S. clean energy policy would emerge. We were wrong. Our fear is that the U.S. was engaged in a covert Manhattan project to achieve energy independence have been assuaged. America's Manhattan project turns out to be largely confined to the production of corn ethanol in Iowa, which our analysts have confirmed from cell phone intercepts between lobbyists and congressmen is nothing more than a multi-billion dollar payoff to big Iowa farmers and agribusinesses. True, thanks to Nancy Pelosi, the U.S. Congress decided to increase the miles per gallon required of U.S. car fleets by the year 2020, which took us by surprise. But we nevertheless strongly believe this will not lead to any definitive breaking of America's oil addiction, since none of the leading presidential candidates has offered an energy policy that would include a tax on oil or carbon that could trigger a truly transformational shift in America away from fossil fuels. Therefore, it is very likely that Iran's current level of high oil revenues will last for decades and insulate our regime from any decisive pressures from abroad or from our own people. We have to note that obtaining open source intelligence in America has become more difficult because traditional news shows have become more comedic, and more comedic news shows more authoritative. For instance, CNN's Nightly Business Report is hosted by a man named Dobbs. Real journalists come on his show and present transparently propagandistic stories about immigration and trade, and then he fulminates about them, much the way our Ayatollahs used to do about satanic Americans on late-night Iranian TV. So viewers have no real idea what's happening in the U.S. economy. Meanwhile, at 11 p.m., something called The Daily Show, which appears on Comedy Central, has fake journalists presenting what turns out to be the real news. Yes, our last Iranian National Intelligence estimate in 1990 concluded that after the collapse of communism, America was on track to become the world's sole superpower and the most compelling role model for Muslim youth, including our own. We were wrong. We now have high confidence that America is on a path of self-destruction for three reasons. First, 9/11 has made America afraid and therefore stupid. The war on terrorism is now so deeply embedded in America's psyche that we think it is highly likely that America will continue to export more fear than hope and will continue to defend things like torture and Guantanamo Bay prison and to favor politicians like Mr. Giuliani, who alienates the rest of the world. Second, at a time when America's bridges, roads, airports, and internet bandwidth have fallen behind other industrial powers, including China, we believe that the U.S. opposition to higher taxes and the fact that the primary campaigns have focused largely on gay marriage, flag burning, and whether the Christian Bible is the literal truth means it is highly unlikely that America will arrest its decline. Third, all the U.S. presidential candidates are distancing themselves from the core values that made America such a great power and so different from us. In particular, America's long commitment to free trade, open immigration, and a reverence for scientific inquiry wherever it leads. Our intel analysts are baffled that the leading Democrat, Mrs. Clinton, no longer believes in globalization, and the leading Republican, Mr. Huckabee, never believed in evolution. U.S. politicians seem determined to appeal either to the most nativist extremes in their respective parties or to tell voters that something Americans call the tooth fairy will make their energy, budget, educational, and social security deficits painlessly disappear. Therefore, we conclude with high confidence that there is little likelihood that post 9/11 America will, as they say, get its groove back anytime soon. Who needs nukes when you have this kind of America? God is great. Long live the Iranian Revolution. That's Tom Friedman writing this week in the New York Times. I think it's a brilliant op-ed. It is his imagining of the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence's memo to President Ahmadinejad. And, of course, the memo presents that everything that the current U.S. government, led by the Bush administration, is doing plays exactly into the hands of those who we purport to be our enemies, and that we would have to take a very different path in order to put any fear into the heart of those with whom we disagree and with whom we purportedly disagree with the way the world should be. The news this week has been about the Iranian nuclear attempt to gain nuclear weapons, and that from our national intelligence estimate, which is a consensus opinion of the various intelligence branches of the United States put together into what might be termed an agreed upon view, we learned that they have abandoned that effort. When I hear American politicians holding forth about the dangers presented by other nations possessing nuclear weapons, I really do feel like I'm in some strange twilight zone, and I do have to hark back to the time of the creation and the original use of the atomic bomb. This, after all, our country, the United States of America, is the country that invented nuclear weapons. Of course, they would have been invented by another country if we hadn't, but we invented them. We should remember that. We are the country that first detonated a nuclear weapon in a fragile ecosystem. The first detonation took place in the desert of New Mexico. This is the country that first used nuclear weapons, and to date, the only country that has used nuclear weapons on other human beings. We did it twice, and we did it, for the most part, on civilians, including children and including infants. We are the country that invented and first detonated thermonuclear weapons, otherwise known as the hydrogen bomb. We are the country that first conducted numerous tests of such weapons. In those tests, we have destroyed entire islands, reefs, and entire ocean ecosystems. We have detonated them in the atmosphere of our planet, and we have done it on the land. And this is the country that continues to possess and has possessed the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons in the world. And we have a president who cannot pronounce the word nuclear. When you hear our president attacking and warning and decrying other countries about of their effort to gain nuclear weapons, we should remember our own nuclear history. It would be best if those nations did not pursue nuclear weapons, but I do not see any way that we can have credibility in asking that they not do so unless we agree to change our own position on nuclear weapons. We're going to take a quick break. This is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, www.newcapitalshow.com. When we come back, Laverne Williams will be with us, and we will be talking about green building and green architecture. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the New Capital Show. Joining me now is Laverne Williams from Stapatia Veda to the traditional Texas vernacular. Houston architect Laverne Williams is fluent in most any home design interpretation. He articulates each project into a declaration of energy efficiency and environmental integrity, bringing a holistic approach to residential architecture. From the microclimate of the property to the mechanical systems used in construction, his home designs make a statement of health, comfort, durability, and maintainability, all wrapped in a highly aesthetic appeal. For three decades, Laverne Williams has been pioneering green architecture in Texas, and it is my pleasure to welcome Laverne Williams to the New Capital Show. Laverne, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
A pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
We got an email from you saying, you know, I'd really like to come to the station, but I'm trying to reduce my carbon footprint. So we're going to do the interview by the phone. And you know what? I absolutely appreciate and respect that.
That's great.
So thanks for coming on today.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I also have my office at my home.
So yep.
I can further reduce my carbon footprint.
Laverne, do you know Ed Masria?
Sure.
Ed was on the show a few years ago, mm-hmm. and at the time Ed was working to improve the education of architects. His idea, and I think this is still Ed's idea, was that 50,000 architects determine what materials are used in this country, what systems are used, and if we can get a hold of those architects in training, we can change the thing.
I can I'll disagree with him on that.
Okay.
My experience has been that I've tried educating the architects. They don't want to. They're so busy doing what they're doing that they until a crisis comes, they don't have time to listen. It's it's the consumer that needs to be educated and creating the demand for the architects to change. And that's what I've been doing.
Okay. Where are we right now in the green building process? Before we get to you specifically,
sure.
Let's maybe do a quick overview. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of stuff right now. What are we seeing that and how do we understand what we're seeing?
Well, I'm not sure I understand.
Well,
we're seeing a lot about green building, of course, and it's we hit the tipping point about 2 years ago where the word green sort of become a conscious word to people. They say, what is that? You know, it's sort of, instead of them ignoring it, it sort of became a term that they begin to understand, that it's about, you know, living a little bit better on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we build a house, I mean, that must be one of the largest environmental impacts that a person can have is when they build a house, I'm assuming.
From an individual standpoint, yes. And that the reason why I do houses, or I started out doing houses, because that's where I could make an impact.
Mm-hmm.
With commercial buildings and institutional buildings and industrial type of work, there wasn't a whole lot of demand. In fact, they didn't even want to talk about it. But I could convince individual homeowners for their own pocketbook and for their own health,
mm-hmm.
and for setting an example for their children. They you know, as the years have gone by, it's become the point where everybody is sort of thinking in that direction now.
It's sexy now, right?
Yeah, it's and I don't know, I hate that term, sexy.
But I knew you would. That's why I used it.
But it certainly is something that is people are paying attention to as they understand more where we are on this planet and what kind of shape we're in and how, you know, sort of human race has become the plague upon the earth. There's got to be some major changes made, and you know if I love what you had to say about Thomas Friedman.
Isn't that a great piece?
That's
I love
a great
that piece.
But you know, one of the things that we have to do is that this country has to step up and take the leadership. Unless we do something about our situation on this planet, I'm afraid the rest of the world is not going to follow suit. Either that, or we're going to get left so far behind.
Yeah. Okay. So the way a person can take responsibility when they're going to build a house, how does that happen? How do you begin to say, okay, I'm going to build a house, and I'm ready to take responsibility in building the house? Take us through the choices and options that begin to appear the minute a person says that to themselves about building a house.
Oh, well, one of the things is that, first of all, they probably don't think about this in this way, but one of the first things that's going to happen is they're going to reduce their carbon footprint, and they're also going to be able to think about having a cleaner air, and they're going to be doing their part about helping let's not use resources wastefully on the planet.
Okay, but they say those things. They say, okay, I'm on board that. I'm ready for that.
Okay.
I believe in it. I want to take that ride. And so what choices begin to appear? I'm assuming
the first choice,
the property, the materials. Let's go through and kind of put some meat on the bones here and help people understand.
Well, it depends if you're talking about an existing home or a new home.
Okay. Let's take an existing home, because there's so many people who buy an existing home.
Mm-hmm.
What can they do? Somebody says, I'm going to buy this existing home. I'm coming into it. I'm going to need to do some renovations on it. What are the, you know, high impact, you know, 80-20 things?
Well, the first thing you do is look at the orientation of the property before you buy it. If you're going to buy a piece of property, okay?
Okay.
An existing home, you look at the orientation, and you try not to buy a residence that has this prominent the long faces of the house facing west and east, okay? You try to have the long faces of the house facing north or south.
Mm-hmm.
In those directions. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
And your outdoor space that you're going to be living outdoors facing to the south, southeast, or to the east, that should be where your outdoor spaces should be, because that's where the prevailing breezes come.
Mm-hmm.
So And so if you're in an intersection, you know, if you look, well, I can't do this. It's kind of hard to draw a mental map of this on a radio. But, you know, if you have choices of buying a home along, you know, in any subdivision, first of all, the subdivision, even before you look at property, you need to look at where this house is going to be located, what part of town. And I would highly suggest that you go to the Houston Metro site and find out where the rail lines are going to be, and you start looking at property that are near the rail lines. We have to get rid of our addiction to the automobile. We got to get rid of our addiction to the subdivisions that are, their only existence is because of the highways and the automobile that they'll get you to and from there.
Okay, so we've sighted the house now. We have found a neighborhood that is going to be environmentally so you're saying that the very situation, siting of the house, plays a large role in the environment.
Now
the specific house. I mean, we're looking at materials. Again, we're looking at a house that already exists. What are the things that we look at going in to try to convert this older house from one that was built decades ago or even not that long ago?
Yeah.
Even recently.
Sure.
What are the things that we can do that begin to make this a greenhouse or a greener house?
A greener house. And greening a house means you know, saving energy and using materials in a way that doesn't cause pollution. The first thing is to look at the orientation of the house, and if you have windows that are facing west or windows that aren't shaded, you know, like on the west side of your house and on the east side, figure out some way to shade those windows from the exterior.
Mm-hmm.
And using trellises with natural vegetation on them rather than using something like wood that will deteriorate.
Mm-hmm.
Make it out of metal or something that will last.
Some kind of awning, perhaps.
Some sort of awning will work. Even the shades, I mean the screens, will work on the outside. Unfortunately, though, they will also block the breeze from coming in and allowing you to use natural ventilation as much as you probably would like in the spring and fall. And so then, so you stop the sun from coming in. And you can also do some things like put radiant barriers in your attic to help reflect the heat back out of the attic before it comes in. Then you can get into things like tightening up the house. Tightening up the house as far as air leakage is very, very important. Half your energy bill here in Houston is just taking half your cooling bill is just taking the humidity out of your air. That's just the what happens with the thermodynamics of your air conditioning system. So the more air leakage you can stop in coming into your house, the less humidity you'll have to deal with, and the better your air conditioning will work.
So this would be replacing windows that are leaky or putting weather stripping around doors and this kind of thing.
Absolutely. Sealing up holes in the wall around pipes that are going through the wall. Sealing up holes in your air conditioning system. You'll be amazed how leaky most air conditioning systems are.
How do they leak?
First of all, the metal, people crawl around in the attic and so forth, and they get damaged. They may be fiberglass ductwork. And if you have fiberglass ductwork in your house, I would suggest you go up and get your razor blade and cut a hole into your ductwork on the supply side and look inside of it. You'll probably find it full of mold. And so now this is the rigid fiberglass ductwork that was used in a lot of houses from like the 70s to probably the 90s,
mm-hmm.
something like that. I have to do a lot of consulting for people that have health problems with their home. It's probably one of the principal, I think it's one of the principal causes of indoor air quality problems in homes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have this fiberglass ductwork in it and you do have mold into it, mold on the inside of it, of course, tape the whole closed when you get through with it. This mold can really affect your indoor air quality horribly.
So, but on the air conditioner, what you're saying is that you could have leaking out of the compressor, or you could have leaking out of the blower unit. You could have leaking where ducts, and so
some of the early flex duct that was installed, the interior of it, the plastic has deteriorated, and the thing's leaking like a sieve.
Yeah.
I've even gone into houses, and the return air system is literally pulling in attic air into the return air because it wasn't sealed properly.
Yeah.
So you need to have a blower door test. And
so,
there's people out there who do blower tests.
So get an expert to come out and check your air conditioning system and assure, if this is an existing house, assure that you have a system that is has its integrity and doesn't have leaks all over it.
And then get into your lighting. Get into your lighting. The incandescent lighting that we have in most of our homes is very wasteful. Change it out for the spiral fluorescence. And, this whole thing, you still can go on the Internet and find out, well, the light from a fluorescent light is horrible. It's not true at all. If you get the warm white spiral fluorescent lamps to replace your incandescent bulbs, you won't know the difference.
Yeah,
I have tried it here in my office with my clients, and they said, I can't see the difference.
They've made a lot of progress on those. We use them in my house. And
that's right.
You really can't even... it's very hard to even tell the difference they've come so far. Okay, if you've just joined us, this is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host, and my guest today is Laverne Williams, who is one of Texas's greatest and most pioneering green architects. Okay, so Laverne, somebody says, I want to build a house.
Uh-huh.
And they come to you, and you start talking, and they say, I believe in this. I want to make a house that's green. I want to make a house I can be proud of. I want to make a house that's going to stand the test of time. What are the considerations that you begin to discuss with them? We talked about the siding and the location of the house. What are some of the new systems and some of the new design aspects and features that go into a new green house?
Well, first of all, it depends upon your budget. Depends upon how healthy you want the home to be. And let me say this, the healthier you want your home, the more costly it's going to be. It's not necessarily making the home energy efficient or green per se. It's making it have a healthy indoor air quality. A lot of the materials that we're building, our whole housing industry is using materials that have a lot of chemicals embodied in the materials that we're building from. The plywoods, the trim work, all this engineered wood, a lot of formaldehyde, which is a carcinogen, embodied right into it. And these things outgas, and as you make the house tighter and tighter, it's even a worse thing that you have to concern yourself with, carpeting and things like that. So you want to look at, if you want a really healthy home, you may not want to look at a wood frame home. We can get a wood frame home fairly healthy, but it will never equal it will never be as healthy as a home that is made out of like AAC, aerated autoclave cement. These are blocks that you can stack up like, you just stack them on top of each other with a little thin mortar about a little bit more than a fingernail thick, holds them together, and then there's some reinforcing in it, of course.
Okay, well, let's say somebody wants to build a house that's going to cost $500,000 to build.
Okay.
That seems to me to be, I don't know, is that a reasonable amount to...
Yeah, absolutely. You could, absolutely. That's not, it doesn't, you can, that you can have a, that's too much of a budget for a house that is a new wood frame.
Okay, well, let's say a $300,000 house. Somebody's going to borrow...
I would rather think about size, okay?
Okay.
Reason I say that is because we have to reduce the size of our home.
All right, well, let's say we want to build what do you think, 2,500-square-foot house?
Let's take it down to 2,000. That'll make it easy numbers to work with.
Okay, 2,000-square-foot house.
Yeah.
Okay. I live in a 2,000-square-foot house.
Mm-hmm. You should be able to build a green home somewhere between $200,000, and you can easily go up to $400,000 if you want to, and maybe even more than that if you put solar system.
Okay, let's build it. I want to build it. I want to build a 2,000-square-foot house, and I want it to be green. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting down for the first time to talk. Let's talk. I mean, let's play like I'm the client and kind of take me through it and what are the considerations and
what's your budget?
How about $300,000?
Okay.
Is that okay?
Then let's see. Okay. Now, how healthy do you want the house to be? From the indoor air quality standpoint.
Better than average.
Better than average. Can you live without carpet?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Good. Because that's what we should be doing. All right. Then for your budget, let's think about having your home being built out of wood frame. And what we're going to do there is that we're going to use this foam and insulation in the walls and in the roof, and we're not going to ventilate the attic. Okay, we're going to put the foam in the walls. We're going to put the foam up against the rafters. I mean, up against the decking of the roof, and we're not going to vent the attic. And the attic's going to become part of the air conditioned space, but we're not going to really air condition it. It's going to be a place for ductwork and storage. That's going to become a basement that we don't have in the south. That's going to become your basement, and it'll probably never reach more than 85 degrees up there, even during the hottest days of the summer. That is, if we can put on the right kind of roofing.
Okay.
And the kind of roofing that I want, I don't want you to use composition shingle roofs on this house.
Okay.
There's contributing to global warming, and you never want to mount a solar system on a composition shingle roof. You'll have to, the solar system will way outlast the roofing, and you'll have to dismount it, and you don't want to go through the cost of that, and that's the reason why.
So what are we going to use, metal?
We're going to use either metal or concrete tile or something other than composition shingles, something that's going to last for 50 years.
So even, and this will be in my budget, I can put metal or galvalume or
yes,
something like that?
Yes, it will as long as we use exposed fasteners on it, okay?
Okay.
It won't be the whoopsie-doo type where you have the concealed fasteners.
The standing seam.
Yeah, and it won't have color, it won't be painted. We don't want to put paint on it. We want to be able to...
What color do you? You want it to be white, right?
We want it to be white, but if you can, but if you're going to collect rainwater on your roof, you don't want to put a paint coating on it. You want to use probably want to use galvalume, just plain unfinished galvalume.
Okay.
And so that you're not contaminating the water with what comes off the paint.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're going to drink that water. And I think we're probably going to want to go that route because the water is so much better than what we're getting out of the faucet.
Right. So we would put a rain collection system on the...
Yes, that's right.
And that'll fit in the budget, too?
No, we're just preparing you for the future.
Okay.
Okay? Yeah, we're just preparing you for the future or so that you can do it. You know, that's called passive survivability. We have to integrate into design passive survivability so that you will be creating yourself a home that you can be able to easily stay in times of crisis, or let's say after a hurricane or some other event, you don't have any power. You want to be able to easily open your windows so that you can have some ventilation. You want to be able to collect rainwater off your roof so that you can have water in case all the power is down to putting the water through the pipe. We're so dependent upon these systems that are out there, okay? And people aren't thinking of independence from that. From an energy standpoint, as long as you have a metal roof on your house, it's easier for you to... And that's another reason for locating the long side of your house facing south and north. You can have your collectors on the roof facing south. And then you can mount the collectors up there, and you can provide yourself the power for at least basic needs for your refrigerator, for lighting, things like that.
So I'm going to have solar power on this house?
No, probably not. Not at this point.
Because
you're going to be, from a passive survivability standpoint, you're going to be preparing so that you can.
Okay, but is that for budgetary reasons?
Budgetary reasons only. You're going to have passive solar.
Okay.
Passive solar is going to be part of the design. Okay. I won't design it any other way.
All right, well, tell me, let's talk about that. How will it, passive solar, it's going to...
The windows on the east and west will be done in such a way that you won't get very much direct sunlight ever into them. We will have ways of shading them from the exterior. All the windows on the south will be shaded so that you don't get sunlight coming into the house from March 21st to September 21st, maybe even a little bit further down into the October. There can be some ways of modulating that.
Well, I mean, am I going to be living in a cave?
No, absolutely not. You're going to have more light in this house than what you probably have in your house now. Unless you live in a glass box. No, we're going to have lots of light. That's the idea, is to create a home where you have lots of daylighting so that you don't have to turn on any lights during the daytime. You're using natural light.
I see. So you'll have some kind of, Clara Story windows or something like that.
Try to, and if we, we would like to face those north, and that becomes your ventilation system. We can bring in cool air or air near the ground on the south side and bring it through the house and exit high on the north side, and it will work naturally. I have, dozens of homes where they don't really have to use their air conditioning a whole lot because they have such good ventilation designed right into the house.
So that's a prime deal here in Texas.
Absolutely.
And other parts of the country where it's hot in the summer and the spring and the wind and the fall, and sometimes in the winter too, is to reduce the use of air conditioning, because air conditioning is the single largest contributor.
Absolutely.
to electricity use.
Absolutely.
In our homes.
Absolutely. It certainly is, and that's the reason why, when you're thinking about a solar system, you're trying to cool your house, It becomes costly to try to put a solar
system. Just forget it. I mean, you'd have to put a bazillion panels to run an air conditioner.
Well, you don't have to, but let me put it this way. When people are thinking about doing something with their home, it seems like people say, I'll just add some solar panels to the house. That's not the answer. Take care of these little things first, the little things that are causing the energy to be used.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to address first. And then after you take care of that, then the solar system becomes much more affordable.
Okay, Laverne Williams, we've only got a few minutes left. What is the role of city housing and building codes going to be in getting more of a movement toward green building and greenhouses?
Well, they can play an important role. It would be nice if we didn't have to rely upon building codes to get people to do this. But it looks like it sort of levels the playing field, is what it does. It forces those who don't want to do it to do it. Which is, and quite frankly, we're in a situation where that may have to take place. The situation is dire, and I could go into that, but we don't have time. But we have got to make some immediate changes now. I would suggest, I want people to go to architecture2030.org.
Oh, give it again. Give the site again.
Architecture2030.org.
Architecture 2030.org.
And I want them to look
at
why we have to ban coal power plants and why we have to do something about climate change and global warming. And that's the reason why we've declared a moratorium on not doing any more projects from 0 to 10 foot sea elevation. It has to do with the biocapacity of the earth. Our projects last 50 years to 100 years to 200 years. We do not want to see the resources wasted in areas that are going to get flooded. And because if we do that, we're using up resources that we're going to need for people as they move inland to get away from ocean rise. We simply can't afford to do that.
Laverne Williams, it's been a pleasure having you on the New Capital Show. How can people get a hold of you if they want to?
Well, they can call here at 713-528-0000. Or send an email to Laverne, that's with an E, LAVERNE, at environment, that's ENVIRON, associates, but just abbreviate associates as ASSOC. So it's Laverne at environmentassoc.com.
Okay. We'll post a link on newcapitalshow.com.
Sure.
This has been another edition of the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold. I hope you have a great week. Take care.
The Bush administration and its congressional allies are systematically trying to convince the American people that Iran is a clear and present threat to the United States. But as in the lead-up to the Iraq War, the administration has been using unreliable sources, exaggerated threat assessments, selective use of information, and questionable accusations about Iran's nuclear program. A United States strike on Iran would directly lead to the deaths of tens, if not hundreds, of thousands of Iranian men, women, and children. The Pacifica National Board calls for strong leadership in Congress to oppose war or any military action against Iran. Pacifica further calls on Congress to limit the authority of the president to initiate war against any country in the world without congressional approval. For the full text of the Pacifica statement, visit pacifica.org.
This is KPFT, Houston.
The Committee on the Environment of the American Institute of Architects in Houston is hosting a lecture and workshop on biomimicry, designing with nature as a model, December 5th, 6th, and 7th. For more information,
the free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.